World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including International Galleries, Weber and Thies Law Offices, and ABC Billiards, an authorized Brunswick dealer specializing in pool tables, custom cues, and game room furniture.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour this morning, our guest is Suad Joseph. She is a professor of women's studies and anthropology at University of California, Davis, and teaches both anthropology and women's studies there. She's very interested in cross-cultural studies of how it is that ideas of self and family and the relationship of those two things to the idea of the state, how those things are constructed and what they mean. She has done research in Lebanon, in the Middle East, in South Asia, and particularly interested in issues of gender and family and politics. She's here visiting to give a talk. This is in the MillerCom series. We have drawn on this series now for a long time for guests on the show. It's always very interesting to have people here from outside of the University of Illinois, and we try to bring their ideas again also to people outside of the community here who perhaps wouldn't attend these talks. She will be giving a talk on the issues of family, gender, and state in the Middle East and South Asia. That's tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. That's in Urbana on Illinois Street. And all of these events always are free and open to the public, and anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome and can go and hear what she has to say. But of course, here on the program is an opportunity also to talk with her. If you have questions, comments, as we talk, something that occurs to you, something that's different than the things that I'm asking, perhaps there's certain points that you'd like to have her explore. Well, we can do that. I know she will do her best to respond to your questions. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. So at some point here, if you'd like to join in the conversation, you certainly can do that. Well, thank you very much for being with us and giving us some of your time.
Thank you for having me.
I was looking at some of a collection that you edited, a book titled Gender and Citizenship in the Middle East. And in the introduction here, there was a line that kind of jumped out at me, and I don't know if I'm making too much of this, but perhaps it would give us a place to start out. And this interested me. It caught my eye, where you write that the constitutions of most Western states define the basic unit of society as the individual citizen. And that's an idea that we're certainly used to, particularly here in the United States, where we think that individuals and individualism are very important things. And then you go on to write that, as a way of contrast, most of the constitutions of the Middle East states identify the basic unit of society as the family. Now, and I guess that's the thing that grabbed my attention. And I thought maybe we could at least start off talking a little bit about that and about what that means. I think we understand, although you could talk about it for a long time, about our concern and our focus on the individual. What does it mean, though, that constitutionally you identify the basic unit of a society as a family?
Well, David, you've hit on an absolutely key point, and it's impressive that you that did jump out at you, because I think this is a fundamental difference. But I would say that it's not just a fundamental difference between Middle East constitutions and American or Western constitutions. This is a very common note in constitutions and in political thought in many countries of the world. And partly it's not that why are they so different so much as I would shift the question to why are we so different, meaning the West. Because in fact, one can trace the history of the development of the idea of the individual in the West as a fairly recent concept. And what I mean particularly is that an individual as unencumbered by other obligations, the assumption that the individual is autonomous and is free to act in their own self-interest, and that they have an unmediated relationship to the state is a relatively new concept, and a concept that's only a couple hundred years old in the West. In the Middle East, but in many other countries as well, South Asian, Asian countries, the individual is not expected to have a direct and unmediated relationship to the state. Their relationships to the state has intermediaries, the intermediaries being, first of all, usually the family, that the person is a member of the family. So women, for example, may be expected, be defined as mothers or as daughters or as wives. For example, in some countries, women cannot travel without the permission of their husbands. What does that mean? It means that they have there's an intermediary between them and their and the state in that they have to go through their husbands to get permission to travel. And that's what I mean by not having a direct relationship to their state. Their rights in relationship to the state go through another body, in this case, the husband. It could be the ethnic group or the religious group. In many countries of this region, there is not a uniform family civil law. The family law, meaning areas having to do with marriage, divorce, child custody, inheritance, are relegated to religious courts. And so one cannot have a civil marriage. This is true, by the way, in Israel as well. It's not just Muslim countries of the Middle East. There is not a civil law marriage in Israel as well. So to get to do basic functions having to do with family, such as marriage, divorce, child custody, inheritance, one goes to one's religious community, and they adjudicate the law in many of these countries. This is not the case in Turkey. Turkey does have a unified civil law, so does Tunisia. So that's what I mean by citizens having to have a mediated relationship to the state, that there's another body, whether the body is the figure of the father or the husband or the religious community, in some case the tribal community. Both in law, the law requires the person to go through these intermediaries, or in the practice. For example, what I mean by practice as opposed to the law is that it could be that in some states a person has their full rights to have a direct relationship to the state, to get services and access to resources. But in practice, to get access to state services, you have to go through either communal connections, patron-client relationships, family networks. And that's, again, what I would call an unmediated relationship to the state. Again, let me stress, this is not unique to this region. You know, the whole idea of bossism, the whole idea of political parties, the whole idea of networks in this country and in Europe is ongoing today. As we know, if you have connection, you are better served.
Well, I think probably for us here in the United States, it's worth noting, taking note of the fact that both historically and in the present, that it is much more common for people to think of the state as the family writ large. We don't, but that is much more common idea in the rest of the world.
That's very, again, very insightful, and I think it's points to a historical divergence that is relatively new. I think it's important in many ways to keep reminding ourselves that it's not what's wrong with the rest of the world. Why are they different? It's why are we different? Mm-hmm. Because it's a very few societies in the world that have constructed this very historically new and in some sense peculiar relationship between the state and the citizen. But again, I think it's important to keep reminding, to not think of ourselves as exceptional, because there are a lot of parallels in the ways in which we continue to operate. It's not uncommon for us to think of the nation as the motherland or the fatherland, or to identify the nation with the father figure. And presidents in this country like to think of themselves as father figures, and they, insofar as they're successful in conveying themselves as father figures, they are more successful at the polls. I mean, one can even look in an interesting way to take a very recent example of the vice presidential debates just two nights ago, where Cheney was described as more grandfatherly and Edwards was seen as a younger person, with the idea that a more grandfatherly figure would be someone that one would want to trust. I mean, this is the way in which the pundits were trying to put it. But why use the figure of a grandfather? That's a family term. That's a kinship term. We still use kinship metaphors, in other words, I'm suggesting. But to go back to your point, I think it's very true that in countries such as the Middle East, South Asia, the family has a very direct political relevance in its identification with a nation and the state that is much less mediated. Resources are channeled through families. People have to go through their families to get access to state services. And the family is thought of as, or the nation is thought of as the family. And this, at least in the way in which we talk about ourselves in the United States and in Europe, is less the case because we tend to think of ourselves as being more contract-oriented.
Well, that's, again, I guess it takes me to a further thought that these kinds of ideas that we've talked about very clearly make the family a political institution. Now, that's not to say that it's not in the United States, but in a slightly different way in the sense that it is, I would expect that people would draw much stronger connections between the health of the family and dynamics within it and how those may be changing, and the health of the nation, so that any changes in family structure, in notions of gender roles, and particularly when it comes to women's rights privileges, any suggestions that those things should change, I would expect some people might see as much more threatening to the health and well-being of the state in a situation like that than we would. Now, I here in the United States, again, people would make that could make that very same argument, but not. I wouldn't expect that would have the kind of resonance that it would in a place where you had this idea about the family.
It's a peculiar kind of dynamic that goes on around family. I think there's a way in which family enters the sphere of the sacred and the divine in most countries of the world. The family is just a sacred space. I mean, one can look at all of the politics about pro-life and choice, the family-based political networks in the United States. Of course, they have a specific image of what constitutes the family. Mm-hmm. And even the controversy that we are now, you know, very heavily engaged in about what constitutes marriage, and that has gone up right up to the level of the national government with the proposition that we might be facing a constitutional amendment or an effort at a constitutional amendment to define what constitutes a legal marriage, tells us that the politics of marriage and the family are right up front and center stage in our country. It's a reality that family is centered always to public policy because all states, including Western states, are invested in who gets to be inside of the family and how the population is reproduced, and family is central to the reproduction of the population. So families are always regulating who can marry whom, what constitutes inheritance, child custody. In fact, one can say that states in the West do far more regulation of families than do states in the Middle East, because the Middle Eastern states have left that to religious courts. So the state, in some sense, is much more involved in what goes on inside of the family, including sexual behavior, whereas in Middle Eastern states, that's left to religious courts to a large degree. Having said that, the family is indeed central to politics in the Middle East, and my talk this evening is about Middle East and South Asia, so we can do a comparison there. And one of the point that you made, I think, is very relevant to develop, which is the way in which family is identified with women and the way in which women come to be the bearers of family, and therefore any changes in the family that may be seen as threatening to the culture are usually the efforts to contain those changes are usually carried out through regulations of women's behavior, whether those regulations of women's behavior are in terms of who they can marry, what kind of clothes they can wear, what kinds of jobs they may or may not have. It's the regulations of women's activities that get to be the avenue through which the family is regulated. And very often in cross-cultural debates, that is, when the changes going on within the society seem to be the result of something coming from the outside, and therefore you want to defend against the alien, the outsider, whether the outsider is the imperialist or colonizer or the West, a general category, or the global transformations. The ways in which you defend yourself against those, quote, outside, external, alien influences is often through controlling women's activities. Because women are associated with the family and therefore get associated with the culture and therefore get associated with the nation and therefore get associated with what is, quote, authentic. These are a series of associations that get made, the effect of which is to control women's behavior far more when the effort is to hold on to a perception of what is authentically yours versus what is external.
So, what does this mean for those women? And I'm sure that there are those who would seek to challenge some of these traditional notions and would want to talk about some wide variety of issues, everything from something like what you can wear to who can speak out in public, to who can really participate fully in politics, to you know, whether or not you can drive a car, whether or not you can have a job outside of the home. Whether or not you should be free to pursue higher education, wide range of careers. I mean, all of those things, some of those things that Western feminists would identify as being extremely important, and other things that they don't have to worry about. I mean, what does it mean? Essentially, I guess what I'm talking about is feminism. I mean, what does it mean for people who would identify themselves as feminist in these parts of the world?
Well, it is, in fact, the feminists of these areas who have been the forward thinkers in terms of the critique of family and the critique of the ways in which women are identified with family and nation in such a way as to contain the possibilities for women. The feminist movement in the Middle East goes back as far as the feminist movement in the West, something that is often not known. There were all kinds of exchanges of correspondence and travel conferences that were held in conjunction with each other of feminists in Europe and the United States and the Middle East and South Asia. So the women of that region were very much a part of the, quote, modernizing movements and the nationalist movements in which women were a central issue. Any culture is always going to be filled with contradictory impulses. And there are always going to be people for whom a dominant ideology, whatever that ideology is, doesn't fit. And there will always be contestations. And women, some women, and including men who are feminists, national leaders, and who, whether they were feminists or not, actually saw that modernizing women was central to modernizing the nation, have been at the forefront of contesting these ways of containing women's possibilities. But many feminists of this region, both Middle East and South Asia, have argued that the current constraints on women that you see, for example, in Iran or in Saudi Arabia or in Afghanistan under the Taliban are modern constraints. Those were not historic. Those are new inventions of the idea of the woman. If you look back 100 years, even 50 years, women's movement, women's economic participation, women's capacity to be involved in local politics was much more diverse and possible than is today in some of those countries. Because there is And the explanation for that is very complicated. But one of the things is it has become clear is that there has been a consolidation of an effort by segments of the population who see themselves threatened by the transformations that are occurring. And in order to gain a foothold on authenticity, a foothold on legitimacy, they've invented a notion of what the culture was. This is an invention that they have transferred to the past. And central to that conception of what the culture was is what family was. And central to what the family was must be what women were doing. Mm-hmm. So for them to sustain a notion of a noble, authentic, free past has required the invention of a concept of a woman that never existed. And this this concept of a woman that they've thrown back, that they've kind of transposed to the past, they are using to impose regulations in the present. But it's an invented past. If you look at women in Afghanistan 50 years ago before the Taliban, or in Iran 100 years ago, or in Syria, they were involved in pastoral economies and urban economies. Women were businesswomen. They owned commercial enterprise. The wife of the prophet was a very successful businesswoman. Women have been involved in religious movements, have been interpreters of religious doctrine in the region, which includes early Christianity. Very interesting research, for example, on Islamic law. You may know that there are five schools of Islamic law, and there's research that indicates that women were better off a few hundred years ago when there were different schools of law that judges could use to interpret and use the legal pluralism, the fact that there were different schools for them to use for interpretation, to produce judgments that favored women. But with the consolidation of law, so that there is only one school of law, often that has led to consolidation against women. So it's a complicated, the use of the past is a complicated process, but we shouldn't assume by the way in which the past is represented by current movements that that is, in fact, a depiction of what the past was.
Yeah, very interesting. Our guest this morning, Swad Joseph. She's professor of women and gender studies and anthropology at University of California, Davis. These matters here that she's been discussing, focus of a lot of her research, work, and writing. She's here to give a talk in the MillerCom series that will be at 7:30 tonight at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus, talking about family, gender, and state in the Middle East and South Asia. And anybody who is interested in attending her talk should feel welcome to stop by. Questions also are welcome. We have a caller here who's been patient, and we'll get right to them. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Caller here is on line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in how these nationalist movements that seem to be, going full steam in the first half of the 20th century, it seems that they came out with a less than really liberating, nationalist agenda for women, even though they talked about women. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about constructions of the nation or of nationalism and how that affects gender constructions. And what were the problems? Are you saying that there are certain groups of people or certain constituency that need to be appeased with certain restrictive personal status laws for women about divorce and marriage and whatnot? Or, it seems that there's a tension between wanting to liberate women and use their power and liberate the nation and then, a feeling that we need to keep this tradition, that women represent the tradition, or they are authentically whatever nationality we are. And then maybe talk about what's going on now where you have a greater conflict, maybe, I'm not sure, between East and West. It seems to be very polarized in some people's discourses, and some, men are turning more to violence, perhaps women as well, and how, women might... And is there any way of them of finding a place to speak that is powerful?
Thank you. You've asked wonderful questions. We could spend the rest of the hour just on your questions. Let me get focus on a few points. You're absolutely right that women are very much caught up in the way in which nation is constructed and in the ways in which nationalist movements organize and represent themselves. A few examples, 19th century, early 20th century Turkey, where Ataturk and the Young Turks were very keen on presenting themselves as a modern nation and using women, liberating women, transforming women was central to the way in which they conceived of themselves as a modern nation. That included changing women's dress, that included changing personal status laws, that is family law. That included educating women. That included giving women rights for movement into the economy, and so forth. Now, were they feminists? was Ataturk a feminist? Were the Egyptian leaders of the 19th century feminists? There's a fascinating research on that in that regard by Turkish feminists, Egyptian feminists, Iranian feminists, who argue, no, these leaders were not feminists. They were modernizers. They had a particular notion of the nation, and women were central to that notion of the nation. But they still saw women pretty much in terms of their role as mothers, but they wanted modern mothers, scientific mothers. So they produced a plethora of manuals to teach women how to raise women, how to raise children for the nation, scientific child-rearing practices. And one can find endless documents of women's journals and manuals to teach women how to properly raise children for the modern nation. I'll give you another example from my own research, more contemporary in Iraq. What is not known very widely about Saddam Hussein is that, in fact, he had extensive programs for women in the 70s and 80s. He was a secularist. He was not a religious and Iraq was a secular nation. He organized child care centers around every factory that they founded. They were in a massive industrializing phase in the 70s and early 80s. He gave women the right for housing subsidies. If a woman was the primary breadwinner of the family, then she got the housing subsidy. Women had maternity leaves, much more extensive than we have in this country, by the way. He had an extensive program for mandatory illiteracy. Illiteracy was very high when he took power. And women, all illiterates, but it was directed especially to women, were required to do 4 years of literacy training as adults if they didn't know how to read or write. Now, was Saddam Hussein a feminist? One could easily make an argument, I think, that he was not a feminist. But he was a nation builder. And he saw it in... He saw, first of all, they were labor short at that time in the early 80s, late 70s. Iraq had a population of only about 13 million. They needed labor. They were importing labor by the millions. If you remember during the Gulf War, millions of Filipino and other foreign workers left Iraq. Why not look for internal labor sources? Women were an internal source of labor. To mobilize women into the labor force, you need to educate them, you need to free them from constraints of family and tribe and so forth. So women, in fact, were the beneficiaries, not of a feminist program, but as of a nation-building program. Now, what happens to women when they are benefactors of a nation-building program that is not a feminist program? You can see that in Iraq. During the during the Iran-Iraq War in 1980, men were being sent off to the war, and women were being mobilized to support that effort. When the war was effort and men were brought back, women were being pulled out of the labor force to make room for the men who were returning from the labor front, and all kinds of concessions were being given to men in the area of family law.
Yes, I remember seeing in the Kuwait Times that crimes of passion or crimes of honor would no longer be punished or something to that effect in the late 80s.
Yeah, if you remember, by the way, the good old Rosie the Riveter in this country, what happened to Rosie the Riveter after World War II? She was sent back home. So what I'm suggesting here is that, again, it's so important not to see the Middle East or South Asia as exceptions and we are the norm. Very similar processes have happened in this country. So the women can, in fact, be great benefactors of nationalist movements and liberation projects. But if those projects are not, don't have women at their core, that is, their core is meant to build the nation, women then can become the victims of that same process at a later point in time. Let me just make the last point here, the East and West question. I think you hit on a very important point, that there's a way in which a false binary has entered into our modern discourse that between East and West, that is not a product of just religious fanatics who see the West as the enemy. We have ourselves participated in creating this binary of them and us, the way we represent Islam as a fanatical religion that we can't possibly understand. In fact, there's very little that cannot be understood about Islam, and there's very little that cannot be understood about Christianity or Judaism or Hinduism or any other religion. Maya Angelou came to visit my Davis campus many years ago and quoted a Roman slave And the same quote has been attributed to Oscar Wilde and other people, but it's one of my favorite. And she said, there is nothing human that is alien to me. If we keep that in mind, it helps prevent the blinding polarization that happens around these categories of East-West. The primary victim of these kinds of binaries, us, them, East-West, is usually women, because it is around the bodies of women that the boundary is drawn between what is us and what is them. And so I, as a feminist, am very concerned about not only the damage that is done to understanding cultures, but particularly the damage that is done to women when we fall prey to these false characterizations of, quote, us and them.
When you talk about the bodies of women, you mean to say that there's a fear of misogyny or a fear that it's okay for men to interact in these other foreign worlds, but women being the bearers of honor and tradition then should not be sullied by these interactions? Or
when a nation, whether it's ours or theirs or anybody in between us and them, tries to draw its boundaries mm-hmm. as to what is inside the nation and what is outside the nation, it tends to do that around regulating women's behavior, mm-hmm. who women can marry, what women can wear, what activities are permitted for women, whether women have control over their children, and so forth. And that's what I mean by writing these characterizations on the bodies of women, because it is women who somehow get conflated with culture. Women come to be seen as the bearers of culture, although there's no way culture could happen without men. So how it is that women get to be seen as cultural bearers and men not culture bearers is a figment of our imagination that serves a political purpose, the purpose being of preserving a notion, and invariably it's an invented notion of what constitutes the culture and what constitutes the family for political purposes. Whenever there is a movement to protect a concept of a culture or an institution of a culture, it's always important to ask, in whose interests is it to protect this particular notion of culture? And once you start asking who's invested in that notion, and how does that notion represent the reality on the ground, you get to the politics of representation.
Well, those are interesting questions for the United States as well. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Swa Joseph. She's professor of Women and Gender Studies and also Anthropology at University of California, Davis. And we'll be giving a talk dealing with some of these same issues tonight on the U of I campus. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think that something we need to be careful about when we talk about the Middle East is talking about it in monolithic terms, because obviously they are different countries, different societies. They have different histories, and a place like Lebanon, for example, is a very different place than Iran. In the same way, because I know you have done some work on South Asia as well. I guess I'm wondering, is that so much different than what you would find in Turkey, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, Kuwait, you know, what have you?
You make a very important point, David, which is that whenever we talk about the other, whoever the other is, there's a tendency to homogenize. Mm-hmm. And that's a very dangerous tendency. There's tremendous differences within the Middle East, tremendous differences within South Asia, and tremendous differences within any one of the countries that compose those regions. In fact, the whole concept of the Middle East, the whole concept of South Asia are themselves artificial inventions of the past century that came out of a colonial period. And in what sense is the Middle East the Middle East? It's middle of what and east of whom? I mean, where did the term even come from? It's a British naval officer who coined the term Middle East because they were seeing as in between the Britain and their Eastern Empire, which was India, and east of that. So the idea that this constitutes a region and the assumption that the region has a culture is itself a modern fiction. Having said that, it still is useful to make some careful comparisons between the Middle East and South Asia. And one reason to do those careful comparisons is itself to undermine the idea that that South Asia is a region unto itself, or the Middle East is an area, a region, or, quote, a culture unto itself. Is when you begin to do these cross-regional comparisons, you see where are the similarities, where are the differences. Ideas always travel. People travel. They take with them their ideas. There are significant differences even within South Asia. Pakistan is very different from India. And India and Bangladesh are very different. Pakistan and Bangladesh both are Muslim-dominant cultures. India has one of the largest Muslim populations in the world, but it's a Hindu-dominated society. India has both a family law that applies to Hindus and a separate family law that applies to Muslims. Bangladesh and Pakistan go by Sharia, the Islamic family laws. India has a conception of itself as a secular state. For that matter, even though religion is the formal state of Pakistan, they have this notion of religion and state being separate. The family systems are very different. Even one can't even make a generalization about India. God knows how many different languages and cultures there are within India. Did you want to pursue?
No, maybe you can. Is there, given the fact that there is that sort of broad diversity, are there any kind of generalizations that you can make that really do stand up?
Very carefully. As I was preparing for the talk this evening, which I do hope people in your audience will be able to join us for, and to note that there's also a 3-day conference that follows it, organized by Professor Kenneth Cuno from the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. As I was preparing for the talk this evening, I was so aware how difficult it is to do these comparisons, because most of the time as an anthropologist, I am working to de-essentialize the categories. I'm working to say, well, you can't talk about women as if they were all one category. You can't talk about Muslims as if they were all one set of people, or the Middle East, or whatever your focus is. So to switch gears, so to speak, to try to make these comparisons is in some sense jolting, because I invest so much time in saying you can't generalize about cultures. It is useful, however, to look to see, are there similarities? Are there areas where at least the investigation of the possibilities of similarities and continuities are worth pursuing? And one of the areas that I think is worth pursuing investigation of similarities and continuities, and by the way, this research has not been done, so I'm making some conjecture here, is the area of family law. In most of the Middle Eastern countries, with the exception of Turkey and Tunisia, family law is in the province of religious institutions. And again, let me specify that that includes Israel. Israel does not have a civil family code. It's like the other surrounding Arab countries. Family law is the authority of religious courts. That's a similar pattern in South Asia. When you leave family law, critical areas of marriage, divorce, child custody, inheritance, in the hands of religious courts, and do not have a uniform civil code, some important things begin to happen. One is that you end up having a legal pluralism. And by the way, I should say, we have legal pluralism in this country. We do not have uniform civil family law. Every state has its own. Mm-hmm. And that's a very peculiar thing. We are the only industrialized nation of the world that does not have a uniform civil family code. We leave it up to the states rather than up to the nation. We're also the only nation in the modern world that does not have a uniform national educational system. We leave that up to the states. We don't even leave it up to the states. We leave it up to the local counties and cities, which makes us, again, very unusual for industrialized nations. But what it does in those countries where there is not a uniform civil code and these are left up to religious course, is that you do not have one legal reality for men and women. As a result, the idea of becoming citizens of a nation is undermined by the fact that you don't experience a legal, a uniform legal set of conditions. That's one problem. Second problem is that invariably religious institutions tend to be more patriarchal. Rarely are religious institutions run by women. They're usually men. And they're usually very hierarchical and aged. Older men having greater control than younger men. The outcome of which is that these institutions tend to have a less flexible view, kind view, or a less open view toward the rights of women. By leaving family law, these critical issues of marriage, divorce, child custody, and inheritance in the hands of religious courts, in effect, leaves those critical social issues in the hands of patriarchal institutions. So you have several things happening. And that is a pattern that is common in South Asia and the Middle East. Hmm.
We have about 10 minutes left. I have two callers. I'd like to try to include them both, but they can help by trying to be brief. And we'll see if we can do that. Now, Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I didn't get to listen to your entire program, but about Middle East culture. It's of course, dominated by Islam. And Islam is generally frozen into the 7th century Arabian culture. This 7th century culture not only rejects any democracy, and you will notice that none of the Middle East Islamic countries are democratic, but this 7th century culture also degrades women. The Quran, it emphasizes the dominance of men over women. It authorizes beating of women. I should think any women's liberation organization ought to be horrified by some of the doctrines of Islam.
Thank you for your call, because you have very succinctly captured one of the biggest misrepresentations of Islam that we find in our popular media. Islam, hardly in anybody's mind in the Middle East, is frozen in the 7th century. It is a religion, like all religions, that has continued to evolve and transform and change. And indicative of that is the plurality of Islams throughout the world. Islam in Saudi Arabia is not what Islam is in Lebanon. Islam in Lebanon is not what Islam is in Morocco or Iraq or India or Indonesia. It is a very dynamic religion. If you listen only to the extreme fundamentalists of Islam, it would be like listening only to the extreme fundamentalists of Christianity or Judaism. They have a particular notion of their religion that they would like to make dominant. It is not a representative of the whole religion any more than taking a fundamentalist Christian view and making that representative of all of Christianity. In fact, many Muslim feminists, and that would seem an anachronism to some, but in fact, you can be a Muslim, devout, and be a feminist, have argued that Islam, in fact, empowers women, and that women can gain, do have rights given to them within Islam, and can gain rights within Islam. And what many Muslim feminists have argued is that the contemporary manifestations of Islam in certain areas, certain countries of the world, from them, their point of view, I'm speaking in their voice, not mine, do not represent Islamic traditions. And there's fascinating publications and work by Muslim feminists who can show you within the doctrine of Islam that what we had in Afghanistan, for example, and in other areas of the world are not true to the doctrines of Islam. But I would let them speak for themselves.
Again, we have another caller here. We'll go to Champaign County. This is line number 1. Hello.
Hi. I'm sorry, I'm kind of unfocused, but I was going to call in and to get you to talk back about what's, I guess, sort of anthropological. you call, you say family, but then you also use family system. I wanted you to, there's a word we use here for clan, and it's mainly, you know, non-metropolitan areas, non-so-quote-unquote westernized, industrialized areas. We still have intact structures of that in areas in this country. And I was also thinking that I don't actually know if primogeniture is actually still the case in a lot of the South Asian areas. And I don't know, in response to the last caller, he is exactly the kind of extremist that if you listen to, you have a caricature of what is called Christianity here. So I would like for you to comment on some of that, if you would.
All right.
Thank you. You bring up an important distinction for those who want to study. Excuse me. My voice is a little... who want to study family. And it does make sense to make a distinction between the idea of family, and I use the word singularly there, versus families, which is the reality of the diversity, the diversity on the ground when you actually look at how people live in those relationships that are called families, versus something called family system. The term family system we tend to use when you're looking at a social analysis and you want to look at the relationship between an institutionalized way of organizing marriage and child rearing in relationship to the state or in relationship to the economy or in relationship to religious institutions, then you tend to use the term system. Whereas when I use the word family in the singular, I'm talking about the idea of the family. And every country in the world, every culture has an idea of the family. We have an idea of the family in this culture that it's a nuclear family, husband, wife, and children. And that is when we talk about the family and our fear about the family, that's the notion of the that we refer to. In reality, on the ground, statistically, that family represents somewhere in the vicinity of 10-12% of households in this country. They are outnumbered by single-headed households. So the reality on the ground is what I refer to when I talk about families, the true diversity, which is what life is. You're very perceptive to point out the notion of the clan. We have many areas of this country where extended kinship is the norm, where people don't operate within just a nuclear family, but where cousins, uncles, and aunts, sometimes several steps and generations removed, are vital to the local economy and to the way in which social relationships are lived out. And that is true in much of the Middle East and much of South Asia and many areas of the world. I think, in fact, we tend to think of ourselves in this country as being individuals, going back full circle to the question that David began with, when we are, in fact, nested in families, we are nested in communities, we are nested in localities in a ways that we often find hard to describe. We tend to use the family as a catch-all to describe something other than the contractual relationships of the marketplace, something other than the autonomous individual floating around in the free marketplace of commodities and ideas. But the reality is far more diverse than the family. But to say that we have this reality that's far more diverse than the family is not to say that we are lone individuals. I think we are far more embedded in socialities, social relationships in this country than we often take account of in our market analysis and in our political analysis, and that some of the dynamics I describe for family systems, and I'll say systems this time, when I'm doing my work on Lebanon, and I make these presentations in California or New York or Washington or Boston, I often have people coming up to me after and say, "You're describing my family." Mm-hmm. And what they're referring to is that quality of being nested in relationships that matter so significantly that a person is always thinking about them in relationship to their own decision-making. And I think we have far more of those kinds of nested relationships, whether we call them family or community or other use another set of vocabularies for them. We have far more of those nested kind of relationships in this country than we have acknowledged at the level of public discourse. So thank you for your question. It's insightful.
We're at the point where I would like to ask some more questions, and I don't really have the time to give you the answer. Maybe if you can give me a minute and acknowledging everything we've said about the danger of generalizations, to say something about the way that we're thinking now about the clash of values, cultures, and political systems that we're now engaged in when we're talking about the United States and Europe, the West, quote unquote, and that of course is an artificial kind of term, and the East, quote unquote, or the Middle East, which that again are sort of artificial sorts of terms. I mean, where is that heading?
I see the whole concept of the clash of civilizations, Huntington's famous term, as an incredibly dangerous blinder to the reality of the us in them and the them in us. If you look inside of the United States, I'll give you an example from my home state of California. The so-called us, when we think of us, we think of white middle-class America, is a minority in California. English has become a second language in California. We are an incredibly diverse country. The there is here, and the here is there. People around the world have absorbed Western commodities, Western values. We here are constantly absorbing and using commodities and ideas that come from around the world. So I think the clash of civilization idea operates more in the realm of creating discourses of oppositionality, then in fact it describes a reality on the ground. The reality on the ground is that we are constantly connected with people around the world, with what they produce, with their ideas, and with their people. And the trade in people, ideas, and products is profound at a level that we have never seen before in history. The globalization has indeed made us into a smaller world, and it is probably more important than anything we can do today is to recognize the us and them and the them and us, to break through these blinding categories of difference and recognize the humanity across cultures and across societies.
Our guest here this morning, Suad Joseph from University of California, Davis, will be talking tonight on the U of I campus, giving a lecture titled Family, Gender, and State in the Middle East and South Asia. That's at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on Illinois Street in Urbana. It's part of the Millercom series. Anybody interested in attending is welcome to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Programming here on WILL made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields catering department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from Horines Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horines Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, other fine pianos. Time now to take a break. We'll have news right now. Market update.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland.